We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is hour two of the show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer for the program. Kyle Mabry is at the controls. In this part of the show, we'll be talking some about the future of biomass for energy production. Certainly, there are a lot of folks who argue that biomass has great potential to reduce America's need for imported oil and gas. Biomass has particular appeal because, right at the moment, it seems to be the only current renewable source of liquid transportation fuel that we have. So we'll talk in this part of the show a little bit about the future of liquid biofuels, perhaps as well some other more near-term ways to use biomass for heat and power. And we have two guests with us here on the show, both from the University of Illinois, from the College of Agricultural, Consumer, and Environmental Sciences, Ted Funk and Tom Voigt. Ted Funk is an extension specialist in bioenvironmental engineering, and Tom Voigt is associate professor of crop sciences. And we're pleased that they could be here and talk with us a little bit about the subject. And we'd be very happy to have whatever questions people have. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. Toll-free 800-222-9455. And you can also send us an email if you want. That's will-talk@illinois.edu. So at any point here, questions are certainly welcome. Well, thank you both very much for being here.
My pleasure.
Thanks. We appreciate it. I think it's interesting here that probably, you know, to the extent that we've talked about biomass and particularly for liquid transportation fuel, people are going to think about ethanol that comes from corn. And we grow a lot of corn around here, and we know how to do that. You know, we have an industry already that's geared up to produce ethanol from corn. But I think that if the country is going to meet some very ambitious targets that have been set, a lot of people say, well, that's not going to be enough. We need to find other kind of feedstocks to be a part of this effort to produce these fuels. And that's where things like the research that's been going on here at the University of Illinois, looking at grass, various kinds of grasses, comes into the whole thing. So maybe the thing to start is just a little bit to talk about, you know, where are we now with biomass? Particularly for, you know, as we're thinking about liquid transportation fuel, but maybe there are some other applications, other energy applications as well.
Well, this is Tom Voigt, and I work with the agronomy of grasses. I started out with turf grasses and ornamental grasses from the horticulture side, and have evolved my activities to work with grasses that we're evaluating for their potential as bioenergy crops or biomass feedstocks. Mm-hmm. And we're working with Miscanthus giganteus. We're working with switchgrass, sorghum, which is about the only annual crop we're working with and evaluating. And they all show promise. The agronomics of growing those plants isn't certainly we're not we don't know everything about it, but we can successfully produce those plants at scale, and we can get rid of them at scale, which is also always a concern. So I think from the agronomic side of things, we are moving forward and have some potential crops out there that can be used successfully as biomass feedstocks. One of our big activities is identifying what we should grow where, and that certainly is maybe not so straightforward or clear cut. If we're able to grow sugar cane, for example, there are three sites in the continental U.S., southern Florida, southern Louisiana, and southern Texas, where you can produce sugar cane. That's obviously it's not cellulosic, but that's a much easier jump to creating ethanol or liquid transportation fuel. As you move northward, there are some high fiber forms of sugar cane that have a little more cold tolerance and can be grown. And then we start looking at Miscanthus, and then as we get further north, switchgrass, or further westwards, drier switchgrass. But identifying or fine-tuning those locations where these plants can be grown optimally is part of the research we're conducting here at the university.
Yeah, these grasses that we're talking about, if people, we have talked about this before here, maybe people might not be familiar with the kind of advantages that they have, having to do with where you can grow them and the fact that they're, most of them are perennials, so you don't have to replant them every year. What are some of the qualities of these plants that make them really attractive for as a crop that you would then grow to turn into fuel?
Well, as you said, mostly perennials. So they have a switchgrass, probably a 10 or 12 year lifespan. Miscanthus might be as long as 15 or more years from a single planting. So that's a positive. Although miscanthus can be pretty expensive to establish, but amortized over that 15 years, cost per year come down make it pretty affordable or pretty attractive. Erosion control. The abilities to be grown on land maybe less suited to food crops than it is to growing feedstock, carbon capture and holding in the ground. So there are some attractive features to growing these crops. In general, what we're looking for is lots of biomass, large volumes per acre or per hectare of biomass.
Mm. And the trick with the with these large volumes is a getting that supply chain together. And I'm Ted Funk, I'm an agriculture engineer. And of course, from my background, I like to look at the nuts and bolts of things. How do you get things done? And I used to think I knew all about conveying and storage and these kinds of things, but when you start studying some of these crops and how those huge quantities are going to get harvested, stored, transported, pre-processed, you realize that there are a lot of answers out there that have not yet been discovered.
Well, and that's part of the problem of where we are now. There's no large-scale commercial refinery in existence yet to do this. I mean, we've demonstrated the process, but there's no big plant to do it. So we would have to have a plant. And then, as you say, the big question is, okay, you need lots and lots of stuff. Lots and lots of grass,
right.
And you've got to figure out, once you grow it, you harvest it, how do you get all of this stuff from the field to the plant where it gets processed?
And that's where our Illinois Biomass Working Group comes in. About a year and a half ago, we started bringing together the farmers, business people, agencies, universities to talk about how we build this supply chain. See, it's my belief that if we can get the supply chain functioning to take care of near-term markets, then we'll be ready for that eventual bioenergy refinery. So what we've been working with is looking at near-term markets such as a community-scale pelletization facility, so that you can use pellet stoves. You can compete kind of with propane heating fuel with the price of pellets. Mm-hmm. So how to put together, to feed a pellet market. The second one that's a near-term viability, and that is replacing some of the coal that goes into coal boilers for heat and power. Illinois burns something like 13 million tons of coal a year to generate electricity, and it's not terribly difficult to replace 10 to 20% of the BTU content of that coal with biomass. So that represents a pretty good-sized market as well, and as I say, to help build this supply chain. And the third one is the gasification process, and Eastern Illinois University is one example where a community scale or a campus scale gasification facility for heat and power has some real appeal. So, again, if we can figure out the supply chain to get large quantities of biomass to those markets in the near term, then we'll have producers ready to get paid for this. We'll have producers and buyers lined up, so then we can move to the next step, to biorefinery.
We have a caller here. Let's bring them into the conversation. And somebody is listening over in Indiana on our line 4, our toll-free line right here. Hello.
Hello. I have something in my memory that started years ago when all this discussion started, and I'm sure it was on Mr. Inge's show, too, that someone said that to make 5 gallons of ethanol, no, 1 gallon of ethanol, you used 5 gallons of water, and it was, you couldn't recover it. It was gone. I was wondering if that's actually true, and if it is or if it isn't, what sort of things come off the process of getting from the corn in the field to actual ethanol? Are there byproducts that you can sell to, you know, chemical outfits or anything like that? And if there is something like the water ratio with ethanol that is more toxic, could you talk about that? Thanks.
Okay. Can you talk about that?
Not with any authority. I work with Miscanthus switchgrass. I'm not a corn agronomist, so I can't very well speak to that.
I would say a couple of things. One, there's some very good resources out there now at the our CABR website. That's bioenergy.illinois.edu about the amount of water that goes into ethanol production, and also there's an archived presentation from last year. We had a conference on near-term opportunities for improving bioenergy production, and there was the Illinois Sustainable Technologies Center representative put together a very nice presentation on the things, the improvements that are being made in the reduction of water use in ethanol. So there's quite a bit of work being done. As to the other question that the caller had, I think about byproducts. Certainly, the ethanol production has a very valuable byproduct stream of and distiller's grains. That's being used 100% for livestock feed. So that certainly has some value.
Well, let me ask you then about cellulosic ethanol. In say you have something like Miscanthus, and you're processing that, and does that use a lot of water?
Let's think about there's two very interesting pathways, and all of this is, and let's admit that it's not to a commercial scale yet,
okay.
But there are a lot of different conversion. I say like this, there's a lot of horses in the race as to how to get from a cellulosic material to a liquid fuel or to a liquid petrochemical replacement. Let's not take those off the table either. But let's say you want to produce gasoline, diesel, jet fuel. You can do it through a fermentation process. You can also do it through a thermochemical process. And both of those paths are being explored. And in either case, you're going to have different kinds of byproducts. And some of the things, some of the answers that we have for the byproducts, we don't, some of those really aren't fully explored yet. You know, there's been a lot of work on the conversion process itself, but we're not up to the scale yet where we know what the markets are going to be for those byproducts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, depending on the pre-processing of the material, I believe that you can use less water per gallon of ethanol with some of the cellulosic feedstocks, again, dependent on how it's pre-processed to get it to the point where it can be distilled.
Yeah. Well, and I have to say my grasp of the chemistry here is not very good, but is it the case that doing the processing of something like Miscanthus, that it's more complicated to use that and turn that into ethanol than it is to take corn and turn it into ethanol?
Again, I'm an agronomist and not a chemical engineer, but everybody that I work with and talk to and things I've read would indicate, yeah, where there's at least an extra step or two in there required to convert the cellulosic materials to mm-hmm. ethanol.
Mm-hmm. And also, if you're going to be using the biochemical approach, there's a new family of fermentation organisms that are needed to, and you know, the ones that convert to mm-hmm. ethanol are pretty well known, but we're looking at a new family, and scientists are all the time looking for better, more efficient organisms to do that conversion from the cellulose, from the lignocellulosic material to ethanol or to butanol or other kinds of things.
Hmm. Well, how is it possible to say something like how far away do you think that you are from having a solid, reliable process, at least, that you know that can be used, that then you would hope that you could scale that up to a commercial level?
Well, at present time, British Petroleum is building a plant in southern Florida, or central Florida, near Highland County, and they will be producing 36 million, or they intend to produce 36 million gallons of ethanol a year in 2013, I believe. And right now they're scaling up, building the plant and scaling up the biomass. It'll take about 20,000 acres of energy cane, which is, again, the high-fiber form of sugar cane, mm-hmm. To fuel that 36 million gallon a year plant.
But then we still have the issue that if we were going to use something like miscanthus, that isn't that
process would be pretty similar.
So this is
cellulosic. It's not.
So,
they're not.
Oh, so this is
so it's a high fiber. Okay. But I'm sorry.
I'm thinking sugar cane is.
It's a high fiber form of sugar, a low sugar, high fiber form of sugar cane.
So basically, we're talking about the same kind of process.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. So they would they then be growing the feedstock essentially right around where the plant?
Yes. It's a very rural county. A lot of pasture land or scrub land is being planted with the energy cane, and at that part of the state, there's a lot of water available as well for the processing. Mm-hmm. So
tell me again, how much what's their target for production?
36 million gallons a year, which is, I think there are plants bigger than that, but that's not a model. That's a real world commercial size ethanol plant.
Mm-hmm. It's about the third the size of a dry grind ethanol plant that would be taking corn as a feedstock.
Okay.
So those are typically 100 million gallon a year.
Okay, mm-hmm. 36 million gallons. And altogether, how much ethanol are we producing now in the United States?
Was it 9 billion gallons? Are we up?
Don't have that number right in front of me.
So it's billions we're talking about.
Yeah,
billions.
It's huge.
It's huge. But that's nothing compared to the targets that have been set for.
No.
For like, is it 36 billion by 2022?
I believe that's correct.
Is that right? And that goes back to the Energy Independence and Security Act of 2007, which was this thing that President Bush signed, and that idea was that we would really move aggressively to increase ethanol production as a fuel additive, so that would then cut down on the amount of oil that we would need to power cars and so forth. And also in this, I think there's also an important provision that they were putting limits on how much of that ethanol could come from corn. So they're also trying to push other feedstocks there.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Let's talk with another caller here in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi, my name's Matt. Definitely interested in the agronomy side of it. I guess a concern that I have with miscanthus that I've heard about is it's naturally a river bottom type plant, and we're talking about planting over large acres across the state or country or wherever. How is that going to affect water use and the water table and things like that with such a, I guess, water-hungry plant?
The miscanthus that we work with is Miscanthus giganteus. It's a hybrid of two forms, two other species, Miscanthus sinensis, Miscanthus sacrifloris. Miscanthus giganteus is sterile. The plant that we work with is sterile. It does not produce viable seed, which is great environmentally. If you're concerned about it, the invasiveness, it is a very low-risk plant, identified as a low-risk plant for invasiveness. It makes it a little more difficult, on the other hand, to propagate because it all has to be done asexually with rhizome divisions or tissue culture or micropropagation techniques. So that has perhaps slowed down the development. It is a grass that requires a good amount of water to produce. When you produce that much biomass on an annual basis, it does require a large amount of water to be pushed through that plant to achieve the growth that it has. Calling it a river bottom plant, I don't know if that's accurate. I can show you spots at our in some of our plantings in the South Farms where the soils are very wet and the plants actually have reduced in size and number of stems that they produce in areas that are wetter than some of the drier areas that we have.
Okay. Does deep rooting affect like the soil nutrient profile since it's digging probably a little deeper than
Miscanthus giganteus is an unusual crop in that in very few studies has it been identified to respond to nitrogen fertilization, for example. In three years, a study that we have currently going on, and we have a site here in Urbana, but I collaborate with the same study in Nebraska, Kentucky, and New Jersey. And we are looking at three levels of nitrogen fertilization. We have not seen a response in the first 3 years of the study. So the yields in the zero nitrogen plots are not significantly different than the yields in the 120 kilograms of N per hectare plot. So we have not seen it respond to nitrogen there. In a study in Rothamsted, England, after 14 years, there was not a response to nitrogen fertilization. I think that's going to be a local situation, however. We're growing Miscanthus on some pretty fertile ground here in central Illinois, and so it's likely that in maybe a less fertile site, there might be a response to nitrogen or to other mineral nutrients.
All right. Well, thank you. So, again, that goes to the that's perhaps another one of the advantages of this plant is that it does the inputs are less. I mean, there's no point in putting fertilizer on. Well, yeah. You know, you don't have to spend the money on the fertilizer.
At least for the short term, yeah. I certainly wouldn't want to say that you would never see a response to nitrogen anywhere because I don't believe that. Mm-hmm. But in some of our formal studies where we're comparing nitrogen fertilization, again, we haven't seen a lot of response at this point.
Yeah. The caller did raise an issue, and I know it is something certainly that I had read about too, and that's the issue of the water use of the plant, and that it will pull more moisture out of the soil than corn, for example.
It does use more water than corn does. In some of our studies here at the university, it does require or does use more water than corn does. In general, the two cellulosic ethanol crops, grass crops that are oftentimes compared for this part of the world would be switchgrass and miscanthus. And in some of the studies that have gone on to this point, miscanthus responds more to water than it does to nitrogen. Switchgrass responds more to nitrogen than it does to water. And as far as yield is concerned,
so if you say you were growing one of those plants around here, what would happen to you if you had a summer like the one we've had this summer, where the first of July, pretty much the tap just got turned off?
One of the interesting things about miscanthus is that it grows very actively early in the year. And so it takes advantage of snow melt and spring rainfall. Mm-hmm. Right now, I think our yields will respond to precipitation, but since a lot of its growth occurs, by the middle of June. I think we'll get maybe a little less than an average crop this year from what we've been harvesting over the last 5 or 6 years.
Really? And you're as bad as July and August was, you can say that you get an average crop.
Again, I think we were wet in the spring, and the plants take advantage of that, as well as the fact that it's a warm season grass. It tolerates the hot, dry weather. It survives that. I'm sure had we been uniformly moist throughout July and August, our yields would be better. But I think we're going to do pretty well, given the dry end of summer we had. Yeah.
Well, questions welcome here as we continue to talk with Tom Voigt and Ted Funk. We're talking about the potential for biomass energy here in Illinois. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Of course, you can also write in a question if you want. Send us an email, will-talk@illinois.edu. And I think we've got another caller here ready to go. Yes, we do, in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hi there. Mm-hmm. I think Miscanthus makes a lot of sense since it's a perennial, and I apologize that this issue has come up before because I've just tuned in. But I am a little concerned about the potential for invasiveness, especially into our natural areas. What kind of research or study has been done on that? What kind of precautions are being taken, et cetera?
Okay. Well, I'd say Tom probably would be the guy to answer that question.
We are also concerned about invasiveness, and we are working. We have several research activities going on that are looking at that. In general, again, Miscanthus giganteus, the plant that we're mostly concerned about from a fuel production, a biomass feedstock production point of view, is sterile. It does not make viable seeds, which again reduces. Its potential as an invasive species. The two parent plants, however, can be invasive. Both the Miscanthus sinensis and Miscanthus sacrifloris do make viable seed. They can both of those plants, and not uniformly across the eastern U.S., but in different parts of the U.S., have variably been identified as invasive crops. And certainly, we can show you a naturalized areas of both of those species in different parts of the eastern U.S. So we are very concerned about that issue.
It is showing up in some of our natural areas already, and I wasn't exactly sure which Miscanthus was being the culprit there. Even on some sterile species, and I do not know about Miscanthus, but they're labeling sterile germination rate of 3 in 10,000 or something like that, which I agree is hardly ever going to produce anything. But is that how sterility is determined here with Miscanthus also?
Again, I'm an agronomist, not a geneticist, but this is a triploid. A naturally sterile triploid. The Miscanthus sinensis is a 2X plant. The Sacrifloris is a 4X plant. And this is a naturally occurring offspring that is a 3X then, or a triploid. I've not seen any literature that would indicate that that there's been any seed propagation or seed dispersal or seed invasiveness for the grass that we're working with.
Okay. And one last question, and I promise to get off. Is there literature that I can turn to so that I can document this for an organization I'm with?
Can't put my finger on it at the present time. Certainly, there was a publication by DiTommaso and Barney a couple of years ago about invasiveness of biofuel crops. Miscanthus giganteus was mentioned in there, and there's a weed assessment index out of Australia that was used to judge the potential for invasiveness, and Miscanthus giganteus was identified as a low-risk plant in that study.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much. Thank you so much. I've enjoyed the conversation.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. We're talking this morning again, as I mentioned a moment ago, about the future of biomass for energy production here in Illinois. And we'll continue just a moment after we take a short break. This is Focus.
I'm sorry, Mama.
Cooper, I know you're sorry. That's why it's going to hurt so much to have to do this.
Margot Martindale is up for an Emmy for her portrayal of the brutal matriarch of an Appalachian family that controls a drug empire in the FX series Justified. We'll talk with Margot Martindale on the next Fresh Air. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
WILL programming is made possible by Columbia Street Roastery, roasting coffee daily at 24 East Columbia in Champaign, also offering a variety of tea and chai. Open Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. to 5:15 p.m. and Saturday mornings from 9 to noon. More information is available at 352-9713.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you here. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon, and we have 10 different topics every week. Try to mix it up, have different things on the show. Let me just mention a show that we'll be doing tomorrow morning because it connects with a report that we have been airing. We aired it on Morning Edition today. It will air on Afternoon Magazine that was produced by CU Citizen Access. And if you want to find out about them, you go to their website. That's just what it is. That takes a look at the people who do restaurant inspections here in our area and just how easy or in some cases difficult it is for your average person, if you're wanting to go out to eat, to find out what the results of those inspections are. There are, for example, in Champaign County, 1,000 places to eat, and they are all routinely inspected. Some of them do fail, but finding out which can be kind of difficult. We'll be talking about this issue tomorrow morning on the program. In the 10 o'clock hour, we'll have three guests: Jim Roberts, Director of Environmental Health for the Champaign-Urbana Public Health District; Doug Toole, he has the same job in Vermilion County; and Tom Anderson, he has the same job in McLean County. And they'll all be with us. Two of them will be here in studio, and Tom Anderson will be with us by telephone. That'll be tomorrow. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics for you every week. We always welcome your questions and comments. This morning, in this part of Focus, we're talking with two guys here, both of them from the University of Illinois College of Agricultural, Consumer, and Environmental Sciences. Tom Voigt, he's Associate Professor of and Extension Specialist who deals with biomass, turf, and landscape grasses. He's in the Department of Crop Sciences. And Ted Funk is an Extension Specialist in Agricultural Engineering. And we're talking about biomass and the potential of biomass as an energy form, and particularly some of the ideas that people have about using cellulosic feedstocks as the source for the energy. So we're talking about grasses. I guess for us here, we're talking about grasses, although there are some places that they use a particular kind of sugar cane to do that.
Energy cane.
And so if you had questions for us, you can give us a call, 333-9455, and toll free 800-222-9455. And here's a caller in Tolono. We'll go right to them. Line one. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Yes.
I have two questions for you. One is this grass harvested green, or is it at the end of its life cycle? And two, since we're talking about cellulosic conversion, why couldn't you take the elm or maple or spruce tree out of your front yard and just convert that? Thank you. I'll add.
Okay. I can take a shot at those.
Sure.
First, the miscanthus is typically harvested in the very late fall or winter after it's after killing frost, and so it's had time for the nutrients to senesce, and this material is pretty much dried out. So it's a dry, looks like a thin stalk of bamboo when you harvest it, plus the leaves. As far as using woody biomass, other kinds of things to as a cellulosic feedstock, there's certainly no reason why it can't be used. We like to look at the energy grasses, the perennial grasses and the annual grasses in Illinois, because we see ourselves as a prairie state, but there are areas of Illinois that have quite a bit of woody biomass, and there's no reason why that woody biomass can't also be considered a possible feedstock. I think in this energy discussion, there are a lot of horses in the race, and there are many different conversion processes that you can use. I, of course, am interested in the near-term process, of which we already spoke about, and their woody biomass is one of the easier ones to handle, even easier than some of the grass materials. So I would like make sure that people do consider that woody biomasses are a possibility.
Yeah, and there certainly are other places in the United States and actually even other places in the world where they're really looking at various kinds of things like that as their feedstocks.
We at our one of our research sites at our energy farm research site in south of Urbana, we're growing 10 acres of woody crops along with all the herbaceous crops we're producing, and we're looking at willows and poplars. Mm-hmm. We we've got a couple of poplar studies, one with the University of Minnesota, one with Iowa State, a willow study with one of the state universities in New York. And then we have two other studies where we're looking at less obvious woody plants and their to determine their potential as feedstocks.
Yeah. Now, one kind of biomass energy device is a fireplace. So, you know, you cut down a tree, you chop it up, you put it in the fireplace, you burn it, you get energy. That may not be the most efficient way to use that, but you can do that. Are you talking about now, we did talk earlier about the fact that, well, one thing that you could do sort of in the short term with this material is it could be a substitute for coal. So I'm assuming there you're just going to toss it in and you're going to burn it. But that also there is the possibility of using it as a source for gasification, as some people do with coal. So then you end up with, methane?
Yeah, the gasification process really produces three principal gases that are burnable. You get carbon monoxide and hydrogen and some methane. You get some other things along with it too. So and then the gasification process, you have the opportunity to clean that up before it then goes to your boiler. Mm-hmm. But woody biomass has some nice properties. In some ways, it's easier to handle than some of the energy grasses if you combust it or if you gasify it. And that's where you see so much gasification and other what I'd call a near-term process is used in the Northeast, where they have a lot of woody biomass. They have big timber industry. And so those were naturally some of the first to come along with the low-hanging fruit, you might say, able to find some good easy conversion facilities and lots of material.
Yeah. So is that what you're looking at here, what you just mentioned, Tom, about some other things other than the grasses, what sort of potential uses are you looking at?
Our main goal is to produce renewable energy through some of our different research projects. But generally, liquid transportation fuel would be our primary interest.
Okay. I'm interested, Ted can talk a little bit more about, you talked about the idea that one of the things that you're looking at is, you know, it may take you some time to really have a real industry up to, say, turn like something like miscanthus into ethanol, because it's, you know, it's complicated for a number of reasons. But in the midterm, you can get something going by using it in other sorts of ways. And one of the things you said was sort of an appealing idea is pelletizing it. People, now there are some places where people have pellet stoves in their homes.
Right.
And I guess in somewhat larger scale, you could use it to not just heat a house, but maybe a little bit bigger kind of building. What exactly is involved in taking it and processing it then into something that you could use that way?
Well, the pelletization process does require some pre-processing. So you have, of course, you have the material stored stored for some period, brought into a depot where you do some grinding. You have to do some particle size reduction so that you can get it into the pellet mill. And then, depending on the recipe that you use, you may have to add some binders, some various things to create those pellets, and then of course, there's a cooling step, and then you can bag it or put it into a container for shipping to market. And it's not that much different from what you see. And if you go down to your big box store or your retailer and buy bags of wood pellets, so it's just a little bit different, material, but it's the same concept. Yeah. And you can burn it pretty much in the same kind of a pellet stove, perhaps with a little bit of modification, just because it doesn't burn quite the same as wood.
So the advantage there, I guess, would be that this is not as complicated as a process as processing it into ethanol.
True,
you can make the pellets,
and the end result is a commodity. That is, you can pretty much put some specifications on it on how much energy content it has, how much moisture, and the percentage of fines, and so on, and so you can and guarantee certain specifications, and then you can bag it and sell it. And it's one of those things that can come fairly quickly in a supply chain in a market.
Ted can talk about one of our extension offices is heated by miscanthus pellets Taylorville.
So. Mm-hmm. Right. Christian County Extension Office has been doing this for about 3 years. They've been burning miscanthus pellets and switchgrass pellets in some modified pellet stoves, and those stoves are actually made right there south of Taylorville in Christian County. So it's a nice example of the potential for having a community-scale pellet-making facility and being able to draw from some radius, with a 20- or 30-mile radius, to bring in larger quantities of material that can then be marketed to replace some of the more conventional heating fuels.
And how does that compare in terms of cost? That is, what it cost you for a bag of pellets to come from Miscanthus compared to other kinds of materials?
It's been competing very favorably with the average cost of propane, and that's where we look at as replacing.
Okay.
So people who don't have access to natural gas, which is much less expensive material, but the propane or heating fuel, the cost, even at wood pellets have been selling for about $200 a ton, and that competes on just a raw energy basis with heating fuel and propane in the last few years.
So for wood pellets, $200 a ton, how much for your Miscanthus?
Well, we would hope that if we could sell Miscanthus pellets for on the order of that $200 a ton, we think people can make money down the chain, and it can be a viable enterprise.
All right, let's talk with some other folks who are listening. First in line, Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Thanks for taking my call today.
Yeah.
I have a question. Do either of you guys look at the energy budgets in terms of how much energy it takes to produce these grasses or to process them versus how much you get out?
Well, life cycle analysis is a complicated business, and I'm not prepared to go into it any great depth, but I know that there are many people that have looked at the total life cycle of production of these grasses and what you can get out of them, and if you compare it with some of the other fuel sources out there, I think the reports that I've seen lately are looking very favorable for cellulosic based fuels compared to some of the more traditional fuels. Realize, though, that life cycle analyses are a point in time, and sometimes they don't realize the new efficiencies of some of the processes. So some of these studies can become dated very quickly, and one example is some of the ethanol studies that were done by Pimentel, for instance, some years back. There was a lot of confusion, a lot of angst, I guess you'd say, over some of the numbers that came out with, because it didn't recognize some of the newer efficiencies and realities that go into the system.
Gotcha.
And in the case of Miscanthus, there aren't any commercial sized plantings of Miscanthus, and so the life cycle analysis that we see has been based pretty much on a plot size work extrapolated up to commercial scale. And so I think in the real world down the road, the cost of producing Miscanthus will go down as there are more acres of it produced compared to what's being produced at the present time.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Right, thanks. I'm sure that what you're referring to, what the caller is pointing to, what perhaps people will think about is some of the studies that have been shown that, at least as far as corn ethanol is concerned, there have been some people who have argued that it actually takes more energy to produce than you get. And I know we don't really need to get into it, because I know that there are some people who would argue that that's not correct. I'm not sure if that's a settled
One reason it's a sticky point is that people confuse what form of energy that they want. Do they want portable transportation fuel versus a stationary fuel for heat and power? And we traditionally, and I think it makes good sense, is we have to be prepared to spend more for a portable fuel than we would for a stationary heat and power fuel. So give a couple of obvious examples, gasoline compared to coal. You're going to have a lot more dollars per million BTUs in gasoline that you can pour in your car than you will for a ton of coal that you can have in a large pile and you run into a power plant. Mm.
I think, though, going back to and pointing back to maybe some of the advantages that people suggest that Miscanthus has over corn, for example. And again, what we're having to make projections because on the Miscanthus, as you say, we don't have commercial-sized, we don't have people with huge fields of Miscanthus. We don't have a big plant producing ethanol from Miscanthus. But is the thinking that the cost You know, when you take a look at the end product, if you're talking about ethanol, that the cost of how much energy it takes to produce it, that would be significantly less or immeasurably less than the amount of energy they would take to produce an equivalent amount of corn ethanol.
I would say over a over a 10-year period or a 15-year period, yes, I think it would, because of the number of trips over the field are reduced dramatically. If you start looking at the value of capturing carbon and holding that underground, or controlling erosion in ground that may be prone to erosion. So yeah, I think that over a period a long period of time, the two when grown together and compared, miscanthus would be environmentally and economically probably a better way to go. A lot will depend, obviously, on what the farmer can get, what the price for that ton of dry biomass at the farm gate will be.
Mm-hmm. So, okay, we have some other callers here. We will try and get in as many as we can in the time that's left here, and we will go next to somebody on our line 4 in Sibley. Hello.
Yes, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
What I would like to know is the mechanics of harvesting, like miscanthus or switchgrass, if you were taking it to an ethanol plant.
We currently, at the university, we currently use traditional hay or forage crop equipment and techniques. We cut the miscanthus or switchgrass usually between middle of December to the end of March when it's fully senesced. We cut it, condition it, and we bale it into large rectangular bales then. It can be other producers have produced round bales, and Parkland College last year they have a planting of miscanthus, and they used actually a forage chopper. So they took the forage chopper through their planting last spring and blew the chopped biomass directly into a wagon.
Hmm. So here again, what we're talking about here is a tall thing that once it dries down, you said, looks kind of like a thin stalk of bamboo.
Well, it's thick enough that it would hurt if you hit somebody with it, that's for sure.
Okay. About the size of your little finger.
Okay. Right.
Okay. And then essentially what you do is you come along and you just cut it off at the ground, so you have this one long stalk, or do you cut it into pieces, or how exactly do you do that?
We will cut it usually about 4 inches or so off the ground, and the conditioner actually will do some crimping of it, not necessarily breaking it up into small lengths, but we'll do a little crimping so you can maintain. It would be very difficult to bale of short pieces. Now, the forage choppers do have some advantages because, in general, no matter how it's going to be used, it's likely going to have to be chopped and or ground to get to whether it's pelletizing or making ethanol or whatever. Mm-hmm. So the forage chopper can be that first step in the process that's going to have to be done one way or the other down the road.
Okay. So roughly speaking, how big a bale do you end up with, and what does it weigh?
Bales that we make are, I think, 3 feet by 4 feet by about 6 to 8 feet in length, and they're roughly 1,000 pounds each.
Okay, so that's
nobody's moving them by hand.
Well, that's so. Your challenge is your challenge is how do you get? You've got these big things; they're very heavy. How do you get? Presumably, you load them on a truck, I guess. How do you get that to where the processing plant is?
Yeah, the square bale system, it lends itself pretty well to moving on a traditional semi-trailer because it's about the width of the truck bed, and it's a nice package size that you can handle with a motorized forklift, and so that works pretty well. Mm-hmm. There's other models out there, too. You know, there's people have used round bales and other kinds of things that are perhaps less efficient, but if you look at the entire chain of how you get the material harvested, stored, and so on, there's different kinds of systems that are in consideration, and still a lot of questions as to which one would be the best.
We're real short on time. I want to try to get at least one more caller here. Let's go to Posodum, line 3. Hello.
Good morning. You answered one of my questions. I'll try to be brief. I was curious about erosion control, if it can be used for that, and also, you know, all the big wet areas we have in Illinois with the flatness, does it, could you plant those like we used to have waterways and stuff, or will it flood out? And then I guess that's enough for today. Thank you.
Okay.
We do see miscanthus and or switchgrass being good erosion controls. Once established, they do create large amounts of underground growth. Plus, we wouldn't harvest them right at ground level, so they'll be stubble above ground. That in both cases would serve as controls for erosion. Neither switchgrass or miscanthus are going to be real successful in consistently wet areas. We are looking at a native grass, a prairie cord grass, which is native to the Midwest and the Great Plains, and it is much more tolerant of wet sites, as well as it has some tolerance to saline sites. And so while we don't have a lot of saline concerns about that in Illinois and other parts of the Great Plains in the Midwest, there are sites where that may be a useful biomass crop.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're just at a point here where maybe we have about a minute left. I guess maybe as a final question, we might just talk about where in the process of developing this as a viable industry do you think we are, and how many years in the future do you think that it would be, particularly if we are thinking about this as a potential for generating liquid transportation fuel?
Well, I think maybe the more salient point is this is an exciting time for students to get into the business. This is a really neat time because whether they're coming in to look at the economics or the conversion systems or the logistics, the agronomy, boy, this is a good time for students to come on board and study these kinds of issues.
I believe that to make this a viable industry, there's going to need to be some penalties or subsidies or incentives for both the markets as well as the producers. The producers aren't producing, or potential producers aren't producing because there's no market. The market, there's not much of a market because there's nobody producing the material. So it's a chicken and the egg kind of situation as I see it at this time. So we're going to need to push some type of incentives or some create opportunities for people to use this technology.
Well, there we're going to have to finish up for this time around with our thanks to Tom Voigt. He is Associate Professor, Extension Specialist, dealing with biomass, turf, landscape grasses. He's in the Department of Crop Sciences. And Ted Funk, he is Extension Specialist in Agricultural Engineering in the Department of Ag and Biological Engineering at the College of Aces. And thanks both very much. Maybe one last thing. Is there some, if people want to read up on this issue, you'd suggest some place they might want to go?
Well, I would certainly send them to our bioenergy.illinois.edu, which is our Center for Advanced Bioenergy Research website.
All right. Very good.
And we have an Energy Biosciences Institute website, as well as www.miscanthus.uiuc.edu.
All right. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Point is, this is an exciting time for students to get into the business. This is a really neat time because whether they're coming in to look at the economics or the conversion systems or the logistics, the agronomy, boy, this is a good time for students to come on board and study these kinds of issues.
I believe that to make this a viable industry, there's going to need to be some penalties or subsidies or incentives for both the markets as well as the producers. The producers aren't producing, or potential producers aren't producing because there's no market. The market, there's not much of a market because there's nobody producing the material. So it's a chicken and the egg kind of situation as I see it at this time. So we're going to need to push some type of incentives or some create opportunities for people to use this technology.
Well, there we're going to have to finish up for this time around with our thanks to Tom Voigt. He is Associate Professor, Extension Specialist, dealing with biomass, turf, landscape grasses. He's in the Department of Crop Sciences. And Ted Funk, he is Extension Specialist in Agricultural Engineering in the Department of Ag and Biological Engineering at the College of Aces. And thanks both very much. Maybe one last thing. Is there some, if people want to read up on this issue, you'd suggest some place they might want to go?
Well, I would certainly send them to our bioenergy.illinois.edu, which is our Center for Advanced Bioenergy Research website.
All right. Very good.
And we have an Energy Biosciences Institute website, as well as www.miscanthus.uiuc.edu.
All right. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Support comes from the Music Shop, celebrating 50 years of service to music education, providing for musicians of all ages in over 200 school music programs. They also feature guitars, amplifiers, digital pianos, and sound equipment in the Pro Sound Center at 27 East Market View Drive in Market View Plaza, Champaign, or at themusicshop.com.
That's it for us on Focus. Up next, the Afternoon Magazine. The host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you very much, David. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3 Urbana. Online at will.illinois.edu. In Kansas City, September wheat, 798.5. That's down 11.75. December, 823, down 9.5. September wheat, Chicago, 690.25, down 10.75. December, 727, down 2.75. September corn, 732.25, up 6.25. December, 742.5, up 6. March, 755.25, up 6. May, 762, up 6.25. September soybeans, 1387.25, down 29.25. November, 1397.25, down 29.5.